Hi again, Patrick Cox in the World Newsroom in Boston with Carol this week to talk language news. Here's the rundown. Shakespeare in 38 languages. Australian texting habits. Language eradication in South Africa. Language purity in Russia and China. And a debate about the staying power, way into the future, of English as the world's dominant lingua franca. That's today's pod, coming up. All right, so joining me this week is cartoon queen Carol Hills. Carol, nice to have you back here again.
Thanks, Patrick.
You have story number five.
I do. And story number five, at first blush, is one of those groovy PC stories. The Globe Theater, the recreated Globe Theater in London, partly to coincide with the 2012 Olympics and other sort of cultural jamborees. In 2012, they are going to produce all of Shakespeare's plays in 38 different languages to be part of this kind of culture Olympiad. Now, the Globe itself, their acting company, will do one of the Shakespeare plays in English, and we don't know which one. And then they're kind of negotiating with all these different theater groups around the world to do them in every other possible language.
So forgive me for my ignorance about my own compatriot and the greatest playwright of all time and all of that stuff, but he wrote 38 plays. Is that the deal? And
I think so. I don't know whether that is exact or whether, you know, he did a lot of things, so I don't know what they're formally, I'm not sure.
Mm. But 38 languages.
38 languages, and everything from Urdu to Arabic, you know, more familiar languages or well-known languages, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Greek. They're doing Turkish and British Sign Language. They're doing one play in British Sign Language, and it may be Love's Labour's Lost. Some of the ones, they kind of know what they're going to do. They've worked with these theaters before, like they've worked in with this Hong Kong director, and they're going to do Titus Andronicus with them in Cantonese, not Mandarin. They're doing, in Arabic, they're doing a musical version of The Tempest with the Sabab Theater, and it's based on the Persian Gulf's sea shanty tradition.
Wow.
So it's kind of exciting. So at first I thought, oh, this is so groovy. All right. But the artistic director of the Globe, whose name is great, his name is Dominic Drumgool, just worth discussing on this podcast just because of the name. He says Shakespeare is inherently about languages and interpretations. And he says, it has long been recognized that Shakespeare, as well as a great playwright, has become an international language and has proved one of the most life-affirming and barrier-transcending ways that people can speak to one another. Well, he goes on to say, his plays have been translated into every major living language, long tradition of Shakespeare performances around the world in people's own vernacular.
Right. And I mean, and that's his argument in presenting these here, right, is that somehow Shakespeare has this currency in all of these different languages around the world. I mean, I wonder how much of that is true and how much of that is just, you know, the Globe Theater, which is the ultimate champion of the bard, you know, whether they are just saying, hey, look, you know, he's the best, and just to prove it, we're going to present all of these plays in languages all over the place.
And they're going to be performed at the Globe, but by these other theater groups.
And again, I find that a little weird, because the Globe is this recreation of an Elizabethan theater, which makes perfect sense to do English productions there if you want to kind of recreate how things were during Shakespeare's time and all of that. But, I mean, if you're presenting, a Hamlet in Zulu or something like that, it seems absurd to present it inside something that is so specifically English Elizabethan. It seems odd.
It is a little odd. But I thought it'd be interesting to kind of hear examples of three different languages that these plays will be presented in. Now, imagine hearing Maori, the indigenous language in New Zealand, and I think maybe a couple other islands out there. But anyway, they're going to do a new production of Troilus and Cressida. Let's hear a lot of Maori. Of course, this has nothing to do with Shakespeare. This is a news broadcast.
Oh, right.
but we're just going to listen to it. So hear a little Maori.
Yeah.
And imagine them saying in Maori from Troilus and Cressida, I am giddy. Expectation whirls me round. The imaginary relish is so sweet that it enchants my
sense.
Okay, imagine this. Shona, a language of Zimbabwe. They're actually going to do Two Gentlemen of Verona, this Zimbabwean theater. and these famous actors, Zimbabwean actors, Denton Chikura and Tondarai Munyevu. Anyway, here, let's hear a little bit of Shona.
Pamusoro pemashandiro avo, chikwata cheHighlanders chinoti chiri mushishire kugadzirira mitambo yacho yePremier Soccer League yemwaka uno uye nezuro Marvelous Mhlanganya.
And so imagine in Shona hearing one of these wonderful actors saying, I have no other but a woman's reason. I think him so because I think him so.
Carol, you've convinced me.
Okay. Because everything goes in threes, I just have a third, Urdu.
Mm.
Okay. Huge language in South Asia. And they're going to produce The Taming of the Shrew, this theater company in Urdu with a very famous...
Oh, that's kind of unfortunate. I mean, Given the role of women in Pakistan, that's an unfortunate bracketing, I fear.
Okay, and I'll give you an unfortunate quote from Taming of the Shrew just to complete the unfortunate nature of this. Well, first of all, they're using a popular Pakistani TV star, Nada Jamil. She's going to be Catherine in Taming of the Shrew. And this quote, of course, okay, let's hear a little Urdu. Of course, this Urdu is another newscast. Just hear the sound.
पहला धमाका कोहाट रोड पर रिंग रोड के ओवरहेड ब्रिज के पास उस वक्त पेश आया जब लोग दफातर और अपने कारोबार के लिए जा रहे थे पिशावर के जिलाई राबता अफसर
And this is a quote that is won't be uttered by Kate, but a man. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty. Anyway, but I must say, you know, language is kind of cool because you think it must be interesting how they come out in other languages because Elizabethan English is rather specific and
it must be
very exciting and really colorful and interesting. And
I imagine some of the translations will be sort of contemporary and some of them will be oldie worldy. So they try and recreate that older language within the translated language.
But a lot of them are doing completely their own thing, you know, updated versions or, you know, different cultures, a whole different cultural approach to the plays.
Yeah.
So they won't necessarily look Elizabethan in costume or anything, any of that stuff.
Right.
And part of this story is that in South Africa, where, you know, there are at least 11 languages or 11 official languages, there's English is kind of the link language and the old kind of bad guy language, and Afrikaans. But what they're finding in South Africa is there are certain theaters there that are bringing people whose first language is not English to produce plays, Shakespeare plays, in English.
Hmm.
And that's sort of this interesting exercise for them. So it's kind of the reverse.
Hmm.
It's not like, oh, let's turn this into Afrikaans or Zulu or other languages spoken in South Africa. They're bringing people together by producing it in English, people whose first language is not English. So it's a whole different...
Yeah.
They're kind of doing the reverse. They're finding that interesting.
Yeah. I remember when I was but a young pup, I used to love going to the theater a lot, something I never do anymore. And one of the things I really liked was seeing things at something called the London International Theater Festival. And you get all of these troupes from around the world performing stuff that was either, you know, indigenous or sometimes a bit of Shakespeare, sometimes a bit of, you know, Euripides or Sophocles or whatever. And for me, the more obscure the language or the more I didn't understand a word of what was being said, the more excited I was by it. Because, I mean, you just follow the gestures or whatever. So I remember seeing a Japanese, I think was a famous Japanese troupe doing some Sophocles or something.
Oh.
It was great. I mean, I just sat there for 2.5 hours not knowing what was going on, and yet somehow I was, you know, greatly entertained. I think it helped to know what the storyline was.
Yes.
And so I suppose that's part of what the appeal is going to be with predominantly English-speaking audiences at the Globe seeing a Hungarian version of As You Like It or something.
I know, because they're saying this thing is partly the Shakespeare in all these languages to also celebrate Britain's many immigrant groups.
I see.
So it's going to be, but you're right, the majority of the audience will still be English-speaking.
Yeah, and they're not going to understand it. And I would say that particular phase of mine was somewhat pretentious, but maybe there's a sort of, you know, a more important point to come out of all of this. Well, I guess we'll see. Well, I have story number four, and there's, in fact, it's a couple of different stories, just a couple of little updates on texting, which is something that people get a little railed about from time to time. And I mean, we've talked about it on the pod before, that it would just
ruin languages and destroy grammar
and spelling and all of that kind of stuff. And it doesn't turn out really to be doing that much. I mean, like, people when they're young are generally not that great at these things. And in fact, here is a recent piece of research that appears to bear that out. This is Coventry University in the Midlands in England. They did a test on kids at elementary schools age 9 and 10. They picked them out from 10 separate schools, put them into two groups, gave one group cell phones, didn't give the other group any cell phones. None of them had really used cell phones that much before. They didn't have expertise. And so the control group, I don't know what the control group did with their time during the time that the cell phone group played around and texted and things like that. It doesn't say. But the texting group, they were tested all the way through, and their spelling and their grammar improved. Despite the fact that they were sending these texts using, over time, presumably, shorthand and poor spelling and all of these things that annoy people.
Were they evaluating their grammar in the texts, in the context of writing texts?
No, they weren't. That didn't matter to the testers. Mm. That what happened in the text existed only in the world of texting. But when you were tested, knowing that you were not texting, they're able to flip. They're able to understand that they can't use texting language
texting,
when it comes to regular texting.
Other written word is, yes.
So that was one nice little piece of research that warmed the cockles of my heart anyway, because I text and I use bad texting words from time to time because I can't be bothered to spell them all out. Then I saw something in an Australian newspaper that suggests that those bad shorthands, at least as far as Australians are concerned, are things that they don't really like. They were polled as to what they found irritating in text. This is, of course, text they received. This doesn't suggest that they didn't use them themselves.
Yes.
But they had these shorthands and emoticons and things like this, and they were deeply, deeply annoyed by them. Men more than women were more annoyed by shorthand. I don't know what that says about the amount of time that people have. And yet some of the Australian shorthand is different from other types of English. Totally is shortened to totes, T-O-T-E-S, which I hadn't heard before. I don't think anybody else uses that outside of Australia. And ridiculous is ridic, R-E-D-I-C, which again sounds... that's just so ridic. You know, don't be ridic. And so all of the other shorthand was depressingly familiar. G-R-8 for great and LOL and all of that kind of stuff. And then other parts of the study showed that almost half of all Australians sleep with their mobile phones either right next to their bed every night or within hearing distance, which was sort of depressing.
Yeah.
Also that a lot of elderly people text, which I think is different from here in the U.S. I mean, texting is still sort of not as big here as it is elsewhere, certainly among people over 65.
Definitely.
I mean, this
is not texting.
3/4 of Australian seniors text, which struck me
as,
yeah.
That's really surprising. That's so different.
Yeah, very different. And then the people who did the study ended up dividing the texters into these 5 groups, which we can all recognize and probably place ourselves in one of the groups. Number one is I am a member of this group, the practy texter. You're the person who sends just a few texts every day, mainly for practical purposes. They say, such as reminding their partner to pick up milk. Not something I've ever done, but I get the idea. Then there is the straight shooter who generally does not text, but responds to text, usually with one word, yes or no. That's the kind of forced text, right? And then the textaholic, I think that doesn't require an explanation.
No.
The silent texter, who is known to pull out a mobile phone and just start texting because they don't like a lull in any kind of a conversation, so they sort of fill it up with, you know, just no awkward silences. And then the mass texter who likes to just send texts out to enormous numbers of recipients.
I'm practy.
Practy.
And I'm barely practy.
I think people of our generation are practies. There's very few textaholics among
I think it also depends on, like, whether it depends on some things. Also, it depends on if you have kids and how old your kids are.
Yeah.
You know, friends of mine with teenagers, all they do is text.
Yes.
You know, my kids are younger.
Yes.
They don't text.
Yes.
Yet. But my friends with teenagers, they started texting and use texting much more than I do.
Oh, I see.
But I probably will.
So the parents do, too. The parents
yes.
just sort of pick up on
yes,
the
they
habits
pick up on
of
it.
The... Oh, mm-hmm. that's interesting. So there you are. Texting down under and also texting won't ruin your grammar.
It certainly won't.
Okay. So, Carol, you have story number three.
I do. And story number three is about something called Fanagalo or Fanacalo.
Oh, it sounds like a board game.
It should be a board game. But it's kind of interesting. It's a pidgin. I don't think calling it a language, I'm not sure one can call it a language, but it is something that was spoken among miners in South Africa, primarily South Africa, and there are variants of it in neighboring countries. It's a combination. It's primarily Zulu with Afrikaans and English. And there's a push now to get rid of it. It has a negative connotation. If you, you know, at first I was researching this and found all these linguists talking about what it is and technically and, oh, it's this and it's mixed with this. And one linguistic fact about it is it's one of the only pidgins that's based on an indigenous language and not on a sort of imported colonial language. It's 70% Zulu. But it is very much thought of as a hangover from apartheid.
A language of instruction, right? Where people are telling
others what to do. That's a nice way to
put it. That's a nice way.
Well, it's more of like your boss tells you something. So it has a negative connotation.
Right.
I found this column by a South African Zulu who was complaining that some of his white friends speak what they think is Zulu, but it's Fanagalo.
Oh.
And it really cheeses him off.
Yeah.
He's like, no. That's not Zulu. That's
yeah.
Fanagalo. Fanagalo itself, it means, it comes from this Nguni, which I guess Zulu is part of. I don't know my linguistic groups in southern Africa. It means lichen plus it and that. It sort of means do it like this. That's what Fanagalo means.
Oh, so the kind of master-slave relationship
yes.
is almost inherent in the title.
And there were two variants of it. There was mine Fanagalo for in the mines, and there was garden Fanagalo, sort of domestic form. Another term for it was kitchen kaffir, for, you know, whites to sort of tell their help what to do.
So presumably there are limited things that you can say using this language. You wouldn't be able
yes.
to say something like, you're not paying us enough, so we're going on strike.
Exactly. People who've looked into it say the sort of height of it was in the mid-70s, and there was probably several hundred thousand speakers. And the other reason why there were miners in sort of gold and silver and diamond mines and coal mines, there were not only a variety of South Africans with different languages, they pulled in miners from other parts of
yeah.
Africa.
There was a need for a common
there was,
language.
It was thought. Yeah. But miners now are like, well, speak our own language. And so the person in charge of mines in South Africa is advocating that it should go.
Right. And this will also be beneficial to homegrown miners, right, who do speak the local languages as opposed to workers from other African countries who don't speak those languages,
yes.
presumably. I mean, it is a kind of pro-South African, might be perceived as an anti-foreigner move.
Yes. This one person who was part of the Chamber of Mines, she said Fanagalo, it was perceived as an element of Baskapide because it was used by bosses to give instruction, which like, you know.
That's an interesting term.
An interesting term.
Yeah.
I was trying desperately to find spoken examples of it, audio examples online. I could not.
So we don't actually even know how the word itself is pronounced.
No.
Could be Fanagalo.
Fanagalo, could be Fanagalo.
Fanagalo.
Yeah. Right. There's a couple phrases. There's a list of words like yes is ehe. Again, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. No is cha.
Yeah.
Please is yabolisa or golisa. Thank you is nkomu or nzakanza. How are you is kanjani. Good morning, so bona or sakubona. So I don't have a clue.
Yeah. Well, somebody needs to set us straight, especially on the pronunciation of the language itself. So do let us know if you know. So how is this going to be removed from the mine? I mean, it's one thing saying we don't want people to speak this in the mine anymore, but what do you do about it? Presumably there's a lot of technical expressions that are quite useful in that language if it is one that is specific to mine workers.
What's interesting is the National Union of Mine Workers say that getting rid of Fanagalo or Fanagolo or whatever would actually improve mine safety, improve communicating and reduce accidents. They're basically saying South Africa has 11 official languages. Workers don't want anything to do with Finagalo. It doesn't help their prospects to acquire skills. It's sort of this waste of time kind of thing to learn.
Oh, so it's like you have to learn it before you... That's interesting.
Yes. They think that basically the language spoken where the mine is based should be the lingua franca.
Right.
And so that's what they should do. And if people have to learn that language, they're learning something valuable, that this is just some sort of created step that has nothing to do with the rest of their life. So they're doing a study within the Chamber of Mines in South Africa on language to try to figure out what is the best way to proceed. Because she said the issue is, what do you replace it with?
Well, good luck to them. It sounds like they're going to have some linguistic changes down in those South African mines.
I just have to throw Shakespeare in here.
Oh, please do.
Because this is, of all the things I'm able to find online, was a famous Macbeth quote in Finagalo.
Oh, that's great.
Quote is, you know, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. So it was the famous, you know, Macbeth thing. And again, forgive my pronunciation, anybody who knows Finagalo. Kusasa nakusasa nakusasa, zinsuko zonke hambake gansani, geleso skati skati zopeli, mazolo ganisile masituta. Okay, you get the picture.
Oh, yeah, no, that's good. That sounded much more like Shakespeare than like reading the news. That's for sure. It may be a pidgin, and there may not be many words in the language, but it can do a little bit of Shakespeare.
Yes. So
it's not a language without merit entirely. Yes. Okay, so story number two. This is two stories that are sort of along the same lines, two different languages that are both feeling the pressure of English. This is something that we do a lot in the pod, and no language that feels invaded by English has really figured out how to deal with it. I mean, whether it's France with your academy or, you know, what have you, it doesn't seem to work for any of them. And you get into all kinds of trouble in trying to stop English invading. Yet you kind of understand why you want English to stop doing what it's doing. So these two languages are Chinese and Russian. In the Chinese example, the reaction has been classically top-down. The country's publishing body, which of course is an arm of the state, has decreed that the purity of the Chinese language is in peril as a result of English words and phrases working their way into the Chinese language. Chinese typically has the names of people and places that are English names must be translated. So you get the city where we live, Boston, is Boshedun. Everything is like that.
So, so translate.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's becoming more difficult to do that with everything, especially acronyms. You know, for things like the NBA, the National Basketball Association, incredibly popular over there. It's just called the NBA. It's just the abbreviation sticks. The CPI, Consumer Price Index, WTO, World Trade Organization, GDP, Gross Domestic Product. They're all part of Chinese now as English acronyms. And it's difficult to get rid of them. Often it's very, very wordy, which Chinese is not. Chinese is not a wordy language. It's the opposite, in fact. English is much more wordy. But translating those acronyms into Chinese make them incredibly wordy. There was one for IBM, it's just like an insanely long series of words. At other times when they have done these forced translations, they don't go the whole way, so there's an inconsistency, so it just sounds awkward and silly. In the run-up to the Asian Games, which were recently held in Guangzhou, there were signs in the Guangzhou metro to help people get to the airport, and they read, "Towards Jicheng," which is fine. It's the Chinese word for airport, but it didn't really help anybody. It didn't help Chinese people because they don't know the word "towards." It didn't help English speakers either.
I'm curious, with other languages, like in French, do they say the CPI and the WTO, or do they just say the letters in French?
I think they do a little bit of both. Certainly, there's a lot of just straight words in French, which we've done before in the pod, like podcasting, for example. And actually, in English, we have to say in English, I mean, I follow soccer, as you know, and the world governing body is called FIFA. And we all call it FIFA, like it's a word, FIFA. Well, in fact, that is a French acronym. And the European governing body for soccer is called UEFA. I don't even know what language that is. I mean, it's UEFA. I've just never even thought about it. It's probably French as well, but I don't know. I mean, they just have become FIFA and UEFA, and I'm quite happy with those as, you know, they're almost beyond acronyms. They're almost words now. It helps that there's a vowel in there, or a couple of vowels in each of those. So, you know, it rolls off the tongue a little bit easier. But, you know, still, I mean, whatever. English does seem to sort of be able to take that on a little bit more. Now, with the Russians, they ran into a lot of trouble because they had a couple of problems. Firstly, they've got a lot of bad translations because there aren't as many English speakers in government, in Russian government, as they like. There are a lot of English speakers recently among the young, but they tend not to be in government. So there was a very embarrassing moment for the Russian Academy of Sciences when the English language version of its website pronounced that something called the Institute of Protein Research, which is part of the Russian Academy of Sciences, it was translated on the English version as the Squirrel Institute. and the mathematician...
Maybe squirrels have a lot of protein.
Well, protein after, yeah. and the mathematician who heads the entire academy, the Russian Academy, was introduced to foreign colleagues as the president of wounds. I don't know.
Wounds. Yes. Like as in maiming?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if he had to go through some hazing of some sort. Anyway, that all kind of went very badly wrong. So at the same time as all of this, and as with Chinese, these things do tend to go hand in hand, there are efforts to curb English usage in the Russian language. So with the Russians, it's also top down, but it's top down in a kind of more... like a completely inappropriate way, as opposed
what
to the
surprise. So,
well, they don't. You're right. They don't have a language academy or a publishing academy like that with the Chinese. They can just, you know, decree certain things. I mean, it's just much more random. And it turns out that the agency that they use to crack down on these anglicisms is an anti-monopoly service. They do this when foreign words come up in advertising. They essentially say, you're breaking the law, you're breaking anti-monopoly, Russian anti-monopoly laws. So they'll tell a cafe to not use the word Halloween, for example. There was a Japanese...
what are they supposed to use?
There was a Japanese sushi chain which had a billboard that said in English, Happy New Menu, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's all kind of... they haven't worked it out there.
What's interesting about both the examples of Russian and Chinese is that, I guess this is an obvious point, but they're both countries that for many decades were sort of away from things.
Yeah.
So it's a completely natural thing. The thing they're struggling with to some degree is what they themselves have chosen to do, which is be more connected to the West.
Yeah, no, it's a huge problem. And there are all of these words that you have to just add to the language that are often in your language just sound wrong. Like, I mean, for example, the word for gadget in Russian, they use a word that is very similar. I can't pronounce it probably, but gadget. But the word gad in Russian means a reptile. It's kind of got or something.
You mean
that's,
the general agreement on tariff and trade, that gad? Or
no,
gad?
No, gadget.
Oh, so the G-A-D in gadget.
So the gad. Yeah, so when you say gadget in Russian, essentially you're copying the English word, but it's got this very negative, because it doesn't just mean reptile gad in Russian, it means something that's dirty
a
and foul.
Gross reptile?
Yeah, it's just got a negative connotation. And so, you know, it just doesn't work that well. And so they're just trying to get people to use more sort of Russo words. But, you know, it's a losing battle. Okay, well, story number one. Back to you, Carol.
All right. Well, story number one, it has to do with many of the things we're talking about, and I'll have a fun translation for you in a minute. Anyway, this is about the old chestnut. How will English survive? Will English continue to be the dominant language as the U.S. recedes slowly, but still receding in the world community, and as these other big countries, whether it's China or India, emerge? Will English continue to be the most widely spoken language? How will it survive? One of the things that people are responding to is Nicholas Osler and his book, the last lingua franca.
Right. And, I'm reading it right now.
Yes. And, you know, he writes a lot and knows a lot about linguistics and about English or the history of English. Really.
He makes me feel very ignorant. He knows so much.
There's kind of reaction because based on technology and based on just the way the world is moving, will there no longer be a sort of dominant language? That's his position. Columnist in the Financial Times says, no, English will remain. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with, he says, look at China, the big new guy on the block. And what are Chinese kids learning? English. They're learning English, so there's a thinking in China mm-hmm. among the billion plus that learning English is still really valuable. He thinks Chinese is difficult. Well, learning any language is really difficult, and Chinese in particular. And that kids all around the world, in China and elsewhere, they're learning English. That's the second language they're learning.
Mm.
Your guy, Nicholas Osler, he talks about the loss of German, the loss of Latin. He doesn't expect a disappearance of English, but it may be the last to have such dominance. He cites 70%, more than 70% of the people who speak it, it's a second language. Osler's big thing is that computers will inspire people to want to write in their own language. And that translation technology will develop so that people will simply speak to each other in their own language. I will speak to somebody in China in English and some translation will go out right. And they'll know and they'll respond in Chinese and da-da-da-da. So the FT guy, he just doesn't buy it. He thinks that there's more to language than just a bunch of code.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
I think it's really hard to know. I just don't feel like I have a sense.
Yeah.
I mean, the world can be a particular way and it feels like it's going to be this way forever and then Maybe it could just change.
Yeah.
I really don't have a sense.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of like for anybody who hasn't come across this book, I recommend it. It's got a ton of really, really interesting detail in it. I mean, I'm not sure about the main thrust of his argument, but the one thing that he doesn't let you forget, which I think is a really good point, is, you know, we're not at the end of history here. And that we shouldn't forget it, that all of these previous lingua francas disappeared after a while. And with Latin or Greek or Aramaic or whatever, there must have been times for people within those worlds, those linguistic worlds, where it just seemed utterly inconceivable that those languages would, you know, die out.
Completely.
And they did. So, you know, there are all these different circumstances around English. There's different circumstances around every language.
The emergence of English along with the printing
press. The printing press.
And
now, of course, the internet and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, there's no question that mm-hmm. English has certain advantages and American pop culture and all of this stuff. But I think it's well worth just remembering that history has not stopped. We have not ended. It's not as though everything is going to stay the same. So,
not at all. You know, there's no model for that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the one fun thing he does cite in the FT columnist, he mentions that the problems with translation, and he mentions some sign in a Chinese supermarket, and it said, in case of dense smoke, use wet towel to cover your mouth and nose. Bend over to evacuate. So as an example, machine translation has gotten better, but it's a long way off.
Yeah. Boy, next time I have to evacuate, I've got to remember to bend over.
And then the other guy who's weighed in on this is John McWhorter, who writes a lot. He writes a lot about language.
He most certainly does.
I think he also takes pleasure in being a contrarian.
Absolutely, yes.
And, so
and
he,
exaggerating a little bit, yes. To make a point.
And he also doesn't really agree with Osler that English is going to fade. You know, he doesn't buy the sort of English as the flexible language school of thought, which means, oh, English is so flexible and that's why it's going to endure unlike other languages that are too formal. But he thinks that the sort of coming to prominence along with the printing press, widespread rise of literacy, all those things have really helped English expand. And he doesn't buy the translation technology argument at all. He also says Chinese difficult to learn. You know, the classic case of ma doesn't mean, you know, horse, mother, scold, or hemp.
Depending on
the problem of tones. But he also says that there's symbols about languages.
Mm-hmm.
There's symbolic issues. He said even now, you know, yes, French may be in decline, but there's still people feel like French is a good language. There's a sort of, I mean, you've talked about this in other podcasts. There's a status quality to languages.
Yeah.
And French,
yeah.
despite
yeah.
it being in decline still has very high status.
I actually take issue with that point of his, though, because, I mean, he lays out this argument that even though French is a declining language, we throw up our arms when it gets cut from university courses, etc., around the United States. But the point is, it is being cut. Fewer people are learning it. We may throw our arms, you know, and, you know, back in the day, I'm sure the same happened with Latin. If fewer people are learning it, that means that the language is dying out, whether or not we, you know, have a strong attachment to it. And that, in a way, bolsters the counter-argument that maybe people will feel this way with English, people who have a particular affinity for English. You know, people who have maybe grew up in, you know, somewhere like India, where they have very much a love-hate relationship with the English language. There may be some sadness over the decline of English, but, you know, maybe if somebody comes along and says it's a good idea to speak language X, whatever that language may be, hundreds of years in the future, you know, and have that replace it in the way that Chinese is replacing French a little bit now.
I know, it's just hard to really think it through logically, because it is hard to imagine everybody learning Chinese. I mean,
it's not going to happen because
language.
The Chinese are not demanding it, and the Chinese are learning English en masse right now. So Osler, in his book, you know, when he makes that claim that there's never going to be another lingua franca, I mean, that's a huge claim to make. But on the other hand, you see his point that with the rising powers right now, they're not rising with their languages. They're not rising with any requirement that we learn their languages. I mean, I still think it would make an awful lot of sense for more people to learn the likes of Chinese, because they're going to be in an advantage culturally, politically, financially, in all manner of ways. But it's true. It's not necessary in the way that it might have been almost necessary to learn English.
It also, I mean, the rise of English seems also to have to do, or its continued popularity, it also has to do with where people would like to be.
Mm.
And, I mean, this is just a fuzzy thought, but the English-speaking world is they're popular places for people to live or study. And so I guess migration and where people tend to migrate to or want to has an impact on this.
But will they be, if those English-speaking countries continue to, well, not continue to, but go into decline? I mean, if the United States has no longer got the economic edge that it has now, and it's already showing signs of that, will therefore the English language, you know, lose its luster, lose its appeal? And if China continues to rise, if you're young, entrepreneurial, what have you, or even, you know, culturally interested in being culturally cutting edge, maybe China's where you want to go to, in which case then...
I think a lot of it's going to have to do with politics, though. I think China could be a huge powerhouse, but I think not for a very long time, or with huge substantial changes, will it be a place where people want to actually move and migrate to.
Mm.
I could be completely wrong, probably am, but it's really hard to imagine, given the, you know, it's a great kind of business center now, but politically it's hard to imagine people sort of flocking to China to live.
Right.
But, well, I don't know, what do I know?
It seems odd to imagine a world where there isn't a lingua franca.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still trying to get my head around that idea. And I must say, I don't buy the... I haven't got to that bit in the book, which is toward the end, where Osler speaks about translation devices, allowing for us all to speak our own native tongues and communicating through technology.
Like,
yeah, I mean, it just and also it's just not the way that humans necessarily want to do stuff.
No, not to people actually converse. It may be to communicate, but it's not the way people are going to engage with other people in the world, I don't think. But we'll see.
Well, we'll
see. That's all fluid.
It's all fluid, Carol. Let's flow out of the studio now.
Okay.
But before we do, tell us what's up on the cartoon site right now.
Egypt, Egypt, Egypt.
Mm.
Great cartoons about Egypt, and just a flowering of cartoons from Middle East cartoonists who, in, you know, we subscribe to syndicates where I'm always trolling through cartoons, or, and suddenly the people who would post, you know, one cartoon every couple of weeks, they're out there. Jordanians and Lebanese and Syrians and East Africans and West Africans. So it's fun.
Well, thanks very much, Carol.
Thank you, Patrick.
And you can find all Carol's slideshows at theworld.org/cartoons. I'll be doing a blog post about everything we talked about today with all the relevant links. I'll put that at theworld.org/language. Also, patrickcox.wordpress.com. Now, if there's a story that you see out there that you think the pod would be interested in, you can post it at the World in Words Facebook page. You can tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox, or you can email me. That address is language@pri.org. Talk soon.